Hey everyone, it is August 9th, 2023. My name's Eric Osterman and I'll be your host. I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. Cloud Posse helps teams conquer AWS using our rock solid Terraform blueprints. Whether you're starting from scratch or just not satisfied with your current setup, book a session with me directly by going to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll have a call to show you exactly how your team will succeed. For those of you new to the call, don't worry, our format's super informal. My goal is to get your questions answered. If you're curious about Cloud Posse or any of our open source tools and modules, this is a great place to ask. For those of us joining through the podcast or YouTube channel, we host these calls every week, so don't miss out. You can register for these live and interactive sessions by going to cloudposse.com/officehours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/officehours. Our call today is recorded. We'll post a recording of the session to our YouTube channel. So if you want to help support what we do over here, please hit those like and subscribe buttons. It helps us out a great deal. It's also a great place to share any of the videos or segments of the videos with your team if you found something interesting today. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. So with that said, let's dive right into announcements. If I can find my window. Sorry. I am trying something new out today and I'm struggling here a little bit. There it is. Okay. Lots of good announcements this week. As I say that, I start with a sad announcement. So the author of Vim, the code editor, has passed away. He has obviously left a legacy behind him and loyal followers using Vim and influenced a whole generation of programmers. So wanted to pay our respects to Bram. Matt Calhoun shared with me that the Mount Point service for Amazon S3 has already entered GA and is ready for production workloads. That's a bold statement, but hey, Amazon said it, not me. This has been something, there's been a lot of different implementations of this probably for the last 10 years that I've used Amazon and S3. S3 Fuse, a lot of you might be familiar with. That was written in Ruby and not, you know, super performant. There was another one called Goofies. I don't know, S3 Fuse, forget exactly how it's spelled. Yeah, Goofies here. This used to be the most performant one. I'm wondering if this is going to be sunset now with Amazon coming out with their own managed version or their own version here. So this is useful if you have some applications that need a classic POSIX style file system to store simple assets. You're not going to want to use this to run like your self-hosted database, but it should be perfectly suited if you need to cache like smaller image assets or things like that as part of your web app, and you can't change your web app to use S3 natively. This is like when you cannot change your application to use S3, but you can write to the file system. Use this. Has anyone already been kicking the tires on this before it went GA? All right. Backblaze has been publishing annual reports, I believe, on how their drives are performing. And it's really interesting because at the scale they operate, the number of hard drives they have and the history they've had going back over a decade, I believe, you can see trends in performance of the drives and longevity. And also interesting how like the same drive, there will be different model numbers of it. And the different models themselves of the same exact in air quotes drive have different failure rates. So, I mean, probably that most of us on this call probably don't manage that much physical hardware. I still find it really interesting when you have this type of data. All right. This was interesting, I thought. The title is a little bit clickbaity. It is for a company who's created this called WarpStream. But the cool thing is that they've done is they've built a Kafka compatible service. Like the wire protocol that it speaks is the same as the one Kafka supports, and sits just in front of S3 and eliminates a lot of the complexity of hosting Kafka, especially in a distributed fashion, since you're relying on S3 itself. Now, I don't understand. I haven't gone deep down into this. I don't know. I mean, S3 itself is eventually consistent, and I don't know what, you know, how that plays with this implementation. But I do like the sound of a simpler Kafka implementation. A little bit less exciting since Amazon has MSK, of course. So pay them to manage it. Maybe this is more affordable and more distributed than you would get with MSK. So that would be the differentiator. Anyone have comments on this?
I'll say I haven't read this and haven't dug into it at all, but at first blush, it seems like oversimplifying. Well, I guess it depends on what you're using Kafka for, but Kafka is a fairly complex beast that can do a lot of things at extremely high volumes and ensure delivery, and you can ensure order delivery, and you can ensure a bunch of other things, a lot of things that I find it hard to believe they would be able to achieve just by sticking a proxy in front of S3 and supporting the wire protocol. But I guess I'll reserve judgment until I actually dig into it and see.
Yeah, they must have made some trade-offs. Like, hey, we support these core features. And if that's what you depend on, great. But, all right. Next announcement is Mirantis. Mirantis is the company that acquired Docker, the Docker Hub and the Docker service itself. But they have been big proponents of Kubernetes, and they have now released open source Cosmotron, which is a dashboard for Kubernetes. Interesting. I didn't see this until just now, that it's I guess they also acquired Lens. For those of you familiar with Lens, it's the pretty, it's like the VS Code of kubectl, and a very nice dashboard for interacting with Kubernetes. Some controversy around that I won't get into. Sounds like they are now the team behind Cosmotron, and this is a new dashboard system for managing Kubernetes clusters. There are so many of these platforms that are not open source. I'm really curious to look at what Cosmotron does and how quickly do you get into, well, that's in the enterprise version. Has anyone taken a look at Cosmotron already? No. You know, kind of disappointing. There's no real screenshots on the landing page. You would expect that.
Is the value they're offering Kubernetes and Kubernetes, like, that's the main thing?
I mean, that is not my interpretation, but I mean, there are solutions for Kubernetes and Kubernetes that, so I did not get that vibe at all from this announcement.
It's the headline feature there. If you just go down,
it's their first feature. No, under down. Features, right below.
Oh, okay. Kubernetes and Kubernetes. Well, there you have it. That's cool.
But yeah. I never thought that was that mystifying to be able to have Kubernetes and Kubernetes and be able to assign, you know, you got an agile team, you know, boom. Here's a kube cluster. It comes with, you know, your Argo CD, all that good stuff. Let them go to town, right? Like,
I haven't stayed on top of it. I remember it was like 1 or 2 years ago, Kubernetes and Kubernetes was a thing at like KubeCon or something. I don't know what the leading implementation of that is today, if you were doing something open source.
The last I saw of it was with a company called Paytm. They're like the Amazon of India. They were messing with that years and years ago, but I just never thought it was that much of a mystery for anyone who really likes to get into the bolts of these data center operating system type platforms.
Well, I don't think it's always, the problem isn't the mystery of that it can be done. It's that you actually got to do it. Like, you know, containers could have been around. The technology behind containers was around forever until Docker came around and made it accessible and easy. So maybe this is making it accessible and easy then, if it wasn't done. I thought there were other projects that were doing that already.
All right. Well, I can get on board with that.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Next announcement is tool to discover. I haven't looked into this too recently, but I like the idea. You know, you have orphaned resources inside of a Kubernetes cluster that's been running for any amount of time, serious amount of time. Here's a tool that helps you try and identify common types of resources that could be abandoned. Config map, secret services, service accounts, deployment, stateful sets, and so forth. I haven't looked into what their strategy is for assessing that, but it's helpful. Here's something showed up. I think it was Matt Gowie posted a question on LinkedIn. If anybody had any recommendations on ways to kind of build your own knowledge base, like GPT-like knowledge base on your own Slack and documentation. This was promoted as one of the solutions. Looks pretty awesome. It already supports connecting with tools like Slack, GitHub, and Confluence, and will give you like a generative AI experience interacting with that data. I would love to have that deployed for like our Slack community and even our internal Q&A. So someone posted this in response to something else I posted on LinkedIn. Interactive visualizations of Terraform dependency graphs using D3.js. So looked interesting. I think the real test is what does it look like on a very large, complicated environment? But these kinds of discovery tools are probably great for newcomers to a project where there's just so much deployed infrastructure, you can't get your head around it and visualizing that.
I think if you have a very large environment and the tool supports an infinite canvas, then maybe it's useful. But if it doesn't, then this seems like it would get out of control really quickly.
Yeah, an infinite canvas would be very cool. All right, next announcement. Where was I? Oh yeah, this one is exciting for me. I am drowning in Slack messages, being in like 15, 20 Slack teams. There was dispatch.co, a startup launched that's, what was it? Was it dispatch.io? I don't remember what it was dispatch something. They were building a better dashboard for Dispatch.co, maybe it was.
Yeah.
I thought it was Dispatch.com or anything, but that's not right.
I was using it for a little while and I can't remember their URL.
Oh, you did give up on it, Matt?
Yeah. Mostly because the way it works is that they have another Electron app that essentially wraps Slack and has like different panels to interact with it. And then your existing Slack like interactions show up as like two more levels, like, you know, one, the main and then the detail. So now it was like a third level of detail. So you had kind of like your inbox, then your actual conversations, then your detail pane. And I just found that two things. One, running more Electron apps is not great performance wise on your on your laptop or whatever. But then second, it, screen real estate wise, it was just like, it felt clunky to me. And I just, yeah, you can see it added that like extra inboxes thing over on the left-hand side. So you have like inboxes, and then there's like an extra, like there's a third panel that, that gets there. I don't know. I had a hard time from a UX perspective making it feel comfortable for me to jump back and forth to them. And I kept having my feeling myself having to go back into the Slack client to answer people and feel comfortable like seeing and understanding what it was, which was defeating the purpose of why I was using it in the first place. So I kind of gave up on it.
Okay. Well, then
dispatched a do.
Yeah, do.
Seems so, promising though. Maybe they just need a couple iterations. I know.
Well, I think it's nice. I think it's cool that what they started and trying to do, but then it's kind of like, then when Slack, the company you're kind of building on top of competing with, is kind of now trying to do almost the same thing, but natively in their implementation. So Slack has now recognized finally after, 10 years or something, that, you know, having dedicated tabs for each team you're in and trying to stay on top of all of that doesn't scale, especially for power users. So they are now creating like a shared inbox, shared activity, shared later, read later sections here to make it a little bit more manageable working with Slack if you're a power user. So this should be rolling out imminently. I'm really hoping that I'm included in that. Next announcement, Amazon has, if you are a startup working in AWS, there are a lot of funding opportunities available to you. Reach out to your account manager to see what you might qualify for. A lot of startups are going to be familiar with AWS Activate, which is a way of getting credits for operating on AWS. But Amazon has a lot of other programs actually geared towards helping you pay for the implementation of running on Amazon. So Amazon, those programs are more geared towards later stage startups and startups who have more significant spends on AWS. Now, if you're an earlier stage startup that is more bootstrapped, angel funded, doesn't have that much going on yet, Amazon has now introduced a program called Build, an accelerator to help support your growth at the early stages in Amazon. The financial support is pretty minimal from what I saw in here. I think it was like $2,000, but you know, at anything helps. It was started because, like I mentioned, these other programs have a very high rejection rate because you have to meet specific criteria. I guess the criteria for this is lower. Okay. Next announcement is, I thought this was a pretty funny. Anyone who's been following Cloud Posse for a while, what was it? In 2020, we had in December of 2020, we had a pretty popular office hour segment called, what was Tacos? Terraform Automation and Collaboration Software. I don't want to take credit for it. It wasn't me. And it was CTO of Scalar, Sebastian, that came up with the term, but now it's really spread everywhere and I see it popping up all the time. Burrito is a spin on that, and it is taking this approach of using a Kubernetes operator to deploy Terraform. Flux supports this, as a more general purpose solution. There's Crossplane, of course, trying to do this. Conceptually, architecturally, totally think it's rad. I want to see it work. Anyone who's trying to actually do Terraform at scale and using these things, it becomes very risky to do it this way and difficult to scale from a triaging perspective. You're basically using kubectl to stream logs to understand what failed in your Terraform, plans and applies. And then, well, how are you giving everybody access to that? And it explodes in difficulty there.
Well, unless the third bullet there gets implemented.
In a simple, yeah, exactly. So this is an awesome solution, provided the not implemented thing gets implemented, and we'll see. Anyways, I want to see these succeed. What I like about this conceptually is, well, I don't want to have to adopt all of Crossplane to be able to do something and like this. And hey, we're already using Argo CD and I don't want to switch to Flux. So this would be a great solution, a generalized purpose-built operator just for doing these deployments. One other thing, let's see, one other thing I've seen, which I really don't like in some of these implementations, is they store the Terraform state in Kubernetes. That's a bad idea. If you lose your Kubernetes cluster for some reason or something gets corrupted there, you lose your entire infrastructure state. And there's also this weird order of operations, like, well, there's a whole lot of infrastructure you need to deploy before you even get to Kubernetes. And now you have state kind of in two places. You have the state that's deployed with your applications that's in Kubernetes, and then you have the state that supports Kubernetes itself and the underlying accounts and networks and VPCs, load balancers, et cetera, that's totally somewhere else. All right. Very minor announcement. Kubernetes has hit over 100,000 stars. That happened just 30 days ago. I just saw the announcement today though. So pretty significant following. Kubernetes is one of the top 10 projects, I think, on all of GitHub. If not top 10, it's top 20.
I mean, given how much discussion there's been about Kubernetes, like over the past, 5 to 7 years, you would think it would be a lot higher than that.
I would think the number of stars would be a lot higher.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
In terms of overall rankings on GitHub.
Oh, no. I meant number of stars.
I'm pretty surprised it's that high up, because it is just a pretty, you know, specialized thing for a small segment of people who use GitHub. But yeah, I would really expect it to be higher. People, I guess it just goes to show people don't like Kubernetes. I'm sorry.
But there are 48,000 or whatever, it's at 38,000 people that are trying to fix something in Kubernetes.
38,000 ports.
So almost one third of the people, presumably, that are a little more than one third, I guess, of the people that started it have forked it.
Yeah.
That seems crazy.
The high ratio. I wonder if there's something there, like... Fork to star ratio, is that comparing that amongst successful projects? So, and 75,000 closed pull requests. All right. Next announcement is another CRD for Kubernetes. This is probably pretty radical, pretty experimental, as they say, under heavy development here. But anybody who's using Kubernetes quickly, discovers operators, which are like the secret sauce of Kubernetes, what makes Kubernetes absolutely awesome. And then the next day they realize, or sorry, then 2 months later, after they've been running Kubernetes, they realize that upgrading operators really suck. And very often you need to destroy them and redeploy them for anything to work. Helm hasn't solved this problem, and they've been working on this for almost the beginning of Kubernetes. Here's a project helping to try and bootstrap CRDs and making it easier to upgrade your CRDs as a process. So it's a CRD for managing CRDs. Pretty meta, but that's what you get with Kubernetes.
Does it update itself?
That was one of the first things I saw in the conversation. I didn't chat. It would be really interesting if it came up with a solution for doing that. Hopefully it itself is an easy CRD to update as opposed to some others.
Yeah.
Let's see. for anyone looking to read a little bit more industry books, this is a pretty cool bundle. Pretty much, pay what you can afford here on the right, and pay at least $25 to get all 15 books related to these topics. Tara Shunt. We've talked a lot about these registries. This is a still young project. It is yet another Terraform registry. What makes this one maybe a little bit more unique than other implementations is its mirroring, which is nice. So that means that you actually have it's more like Artifactory in that sense, that you have a snapshot of the Terraform providers. I think they've only implemented providers so far. Yeah, provider. So I'd like to see this type of thing for modules and providers, so you have some confidence that even if your dependent open source modules go away, that you're fully deployable.
Yeah, it's a pull-through cache, right? The way that it works?
Yeah, I think so. Cool, next announcement. Oh, missed one or two here. So one of the things I've been kind of half seriously looking at, I don't really want to be responsible for managing the uptime of a registry for Terraform providers and modules, but I am curious what others are doing. Here's something that I came across. It was via Hacker News. It is an end-to-end solution for self-hosting your own Terraform registry, complete with the GitHub Actions. The service itself that speaks the Terraform registry REST protocol, and it supports pluggable upstreams for your modules. Well, I think it might only support providers right now, and one of those is GitHub, so it can implement your own Terraform registry using GitHub as your artifact storage. Personally, I think I'm more interested in a solution that is going to be a little bit more AWS-centric, not hosting anything but Lambda's API gateway and S3, and a low-cost implementation at that. Next, almost done here. Yeah. So EKS has improved how add-ons are managed in general, and we've been rolling that out through our Cloud Posse modules for Kubernetes and Kubernetes add-ons. Now there is a CSI driver add-on for EFS. We've been deploying this separately just with Terraform in our case and a Helm chart, but now it's just an add-on, so that simplifies things as well. Any other announcements? That's the end of my list.
I posted two announcements in the Zoom chat.
All right. Hey, good to see you, Vlad.
Yeah, I was late. Sorry.
I've got one to announce as well.
Okay, cool. Let's take a quick look here. So Amazon S3 Glacier flexible restore time. By up to 85% using standard retrieval. Do you want to summarize this one, Vlad?
Yeah, so retrievals from Glacier Flexible Restore are now in the order of minutes. It's way faster, awesome, lovely, yay.
That's cool. Yeah. And the other one?
Is DataSync now supports syncing from other clouds, which was unexpected, like DigitalOcean, BlackBlaze, Cloudflare R2, Oracle Cloud Storage to S3. So this one was really interesting and somewhat unexpected.
Has DataSync existed? I haven't heard of the service before.
Oh, yeah, no. It's been a service for a while.
So now they added... That's cool. I don't know. My sneaky suspicion is because Cloudflare just announced, I forget what they called it, but Slurp, right? to download from S3. So the, you know, so Amazon obviously has to tit for tat implement this. Cool. Good to know.
Yeah, this will eliminate a bunch of data syncing jobs that other that we had through Glue or other custom pipelines.
I think data sync used to be called data transfer service. That's probably why you don't recognize it. That was their original like name for it when it when they first launched it, and that was their whole idea was to get data like onto. Originally, it was to get data onto the AWS platform, and then they expanded it to for like DR and HA scenarios to be able to sync to various different places.
That makes sense. So, also, just I guess for anyone else to connecting the dots, I believe data transfer into AWS and S3 is free, right? So that's a convenient thing. Let's see.
It's price per gigabyte, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, it is?
I think they changed the pricing on it now, yeah.
Oh, okay. I thought data transfer into AWS was always free, but that's too bad.
Does anyone know if DataSync supports Google Drive?
Oh, let's see.
In the announcement, there was Google Cloud Storage, I think. I don't think Drive is there.
Okay. No worries. I'll dig around in the docs. I'll be sure to share an office hours channel if I come across anything. I feel like that'd be a good use case.
Where was data sync into AWS, or where was data ingestion to AWS not free? Eric, you just mentioned that you thought.
Well, you said that when it's not free. So, I thought it was always free into AWS, but
I thought.
Yeah. But so
why do you question that now? I missed something.
Oh, somebody else said that this is price per gig transferred. So that, therefore, yeah.
DataSync is 1.25 cents per gigabyte transferred.
So there's a difference between network costs and the managed service that is this that makes the transfer easier.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they charge you like Vlad said for the
okay. So yeah, there are no transfer, but there's processing.
But it's only you have to pay it's only 1.25 cents per gigabyte. It's not like it's an exorbitant fee.
Some people have a lot of gigabytes. That's going to add up.
I mean, on the orders of petabytes, it's still a pretty reasonable like fee to turn it in, to get it in. But yeah, there you go. Whatever that is that what it's called? The thing where you can give them they drive up a truck and you give them a bunch of hard drives and they'll drive them to the data center and load it for you.
Yeah, that's cool stuff.
Yeah. Snowmobile.
Snowmobile.
Snowball. Snowball.
Snowball, that's it.
Yeah, that's it. I know it had some name that was had to do with snow.
Depending what your data is, sometimes you just have to put it on a physical media.
What's downfall.page?
No, that's too depressing.
Another speculative execution attack.
It's from the question that I asked in Office Hours channel. This is probably the latest AMD CPU vulnerabilities that have come out. Now, AWS have announced that they are not vulnerable to these attacks due to the architecture. But I was just like kind of asking more for the greater audience and potentially even those that are running Kubernetes on alternative cloud providers or non-AWS implementations, if they have any specific security recommendations or security practices that they're implementing to protect against this. And the other one was RAS, which is also, again, similar to CPU stealing.
Anyone?
What's the question?
Is there anything else you can do, you know, that's in your control versus, you know, depending on the cloud provider to be able to isolate against these types of vulnerabilities? Also, it's really interesting. Like, I guess, you know, Amazon with their infinite money can solve these things, but you know, how, what's where's DigitalOcean on this, for example, or smaller clouds?
Well, their ability to defend. If you look at the CVE numbering, it's been almost a year since the vulnerabilities, the number has been secured. So in this case, AWS is well patched. Intel has already released the firmware update. So if you're running your own infrastructure, you probably want to prioritize patching your systems. If you're using a cloud provider, then you'll want to reach out to your cloud provider and you know validate that they've patched their systems, because this is at the microcode level. It has to be you'll need a patch hardware.
So interestingly, the AWS page where they say that they're not vulnerable is only released like this month. So does that mean that potentially AWS have under the hood been potentially vulnerable to downfall over the last year and just not acknowledged it?
That's a
likely.
That's likely. Yeah, absolutely. But that presumes more than the researcher knew about the vulnerability and then was able to exploit it, which is
I want to jump in here. So the reason AWS says that they weren't vulnerable is because they don't share actual physical cores between customers. The way they designed their EC2 offerings and stuff is that each core is dedicated to a customer. For these attacks to actually be vulnerable, you need to share cores. So not a problem. If you're running EC2s or whatever, if you're running Kubernetes, you get a host, you get cores, and you run your own workloads on top of that. So because you're running your own thing, you are responsible for securing that. And that cannot be patched to the microcode level of the CPU because that's already there. You need to secure your own workloads, and that's a totally different conversation. So we need to make the clear distinction. Are we talking about stuff that is handled by AWS, which is the EC2 and the physical stuff? They have security bulletins for this where they say they both apply the microcode and that they're not vulnerable because there is no sharing of CPU cores between customers. Like AWS is very strict about security.
No,
that's the thing. The second thing is if you're running Kubernetes, you're responsible for securing stuff, and that's a whole different topic.
Yeah. So Vlad, I was inferring the hardware side of it, number one. And number two, even though I do agree with you that AWS is very strict around their security, I do not agree with the statement that the cores are isolated, because then CPU stealing would not be a thing. And CPU stealing has been an issue with AWS, noisy neighbors, and you can look this up in anywhere on the net where it is actually potentially impacting other customers. And I've actually seen this in my own time with Amazon as well.
I will share a link soon. Let me find it.
Sure.
And I think that also disregards the AWS common services that are running on top of like hardware that might have this vulnerability. We don't have, you know, insight into it, obviously, but you know, clearly Lambda runs on some physical compute, you know, somewhere, and S3 runs on physical compute, and, you know, whatever, at every service here runs on physical compute. Whether or not those were vulnerable at a base level, we don't know either, because it hasn't been communicated. But
yeah. But it also goes, if you want to then go into the Kubernetes side of it, and you're running something like EKS, where AWS is managing the control plane for you, like at that level, can these types of attack surfaces then appear on the managed service layer above, well, still within the control plane of AWS, but just at the Kubernetes stack side of it. And like I said, this is probably a deep, deep discussion and a very dark rabbit hole to get into.
Yeah. All right. Any other announcements we didn't cover yet? Cool. Let's dive into Q&A. Any questions we can get answered today? It seems like we already answered the one that we were going to cover here. Is that accurate, Alan?
Yep.
Eric, we're kind of at the beginning, as you know, of a bit of a sort of Cloud Posse style modules and components adoption journey. I'm wondering what, like, do you kind of lint stuff in a certain way to make sure it's like Cloud Posse-ian style? Do you know what I mean? And it's like, I know guess it's like linting and the peer reviews and all that kind of stuff. It feels like there's a lot there. I don't know how you do it.
Yeah. I'll be honest, we don't do enough of that linting that it should match Cloud Posse standards. We actually had a little bit more of it in some legacy stuff that we had implemented a long time in GitHub Actions, but we recently deprecated that as we moved to a simpler approach with our shared action workflows. It is something we need to address pretty soon. One of our customers is pretty heavy into the linting and the standards there. And since we don't have the same linting going on, we're constantly kind of fighting and formatting and how to do that. So I'd expect that we'll do something like that, Q4 probably.
We do kind of have what I would consider a style guide, but we haven't formalized it probably enough and published it. That might be something interesting to do.
Yeah,
like how to build a module in a Cloud Posse way, like all the things that we do. I know we have some of it documented, but not in that.
This is the closest thing we have right now that we've been following internally, and it's like what Matt says is kind of like a style guide, but we haven't codified it in terms of tflint or something similar. So I can share that.
That's kind of good to know. Good to know it's not a solved problem. Because I was sort of imagining I would just say to people, hey, start writing, just do what they do.
But
it takes a while of, you've got to kind of live it for a while, haven't you, before it sort of is second nature. And I was wondering if I could shortcut any of that, but like everything in life, I just have to do the work.
Yeah, there's things that we haven't gotten around to that, you wouldn't imagine the number of things we want to do that we just can't prioritize without sponsors or backers. And sometimes we're fortunate, like if you check out our Atmos channel, I think somebody came up with a JSON schema for Atmos before we did. We've implemented support for JSON schema, but we didn't even come up with a schema for our own schema. And it's kind of one of those situations. So fortunately, somebody's contributed it. If somebody happened, to be listening and felt compelled to come up with a style guide based on kind of what this doc has and other suggestions, I would be, very obliged to take a look at it. All right. Any other questions?
I have a question about monorepos and how people are managing them in GitHub. I have a personal problem at the moment that we have a GitHub action for each project within the monorepo. So whenever one project changes, we can't set that pipeline as required in GitHub. And for that reason, if you auto merge, you can actually end up in a situation where you merge into main before the tests have passed, and then you can have a test failing, and then you have the trouble in main. So I try to create one main pipeline that'll do some labeling and some if else, and then run the sub actions. But the labeling that happens in the PR cannot be used in the same action. So I just wonder how others are managing a monorepo and making sure that you can't accidentally merge into main.
One strategy I've seen that's kind of off the shelf, I believe it's Mergify that implements it. It lets you run checks on all the things that have run, and then you can prevent merging until the checking action, the checking service provided by Mergify succeeds. I've seen similar implementations with GitHub actions. So you have another action then that is triggered on when actions run are completed, and then can provide a status. And then you have your branch protections require that passing.
Have you considered using branching? So depending on how many, child repos you have in there, just running them into their own branch. So if you've got like a front end and a back end service that's in a monorepo, as a basic example of this, you have any front end code gets merged into a front end branch, which runs a specific action on that branch. And the same for your back end service, it goes into a back end branch and it runs specific actions for that branch, and main basically just becomes a central code piece and doesn't actually run any deployments.
Yes. Is that a valid monorepo approach?
That's basically turning your monorepo into a non-monorepo at that point.
Yeah.
It's hacky, but it works.
Are you talking about monorepo for applications or monorepo for Terraform?
You know, or both. So we really went the full way. We have Terraform living next to Python backend code and Node.js frontend code, and it's all within the same repo.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of monorepo tools out there. That specifically are made for all of the tooling and determining dependencies among monorepo members and running specific pipelines in a consistent way, like having you come up with a methodology where you say we have like kind of build, test, tag, release, pipelines, but then you can opt in and define custom steps depending on what the language is and what your project is for each of those things. So, there's a whole bunch of them out there. You know, Bazel is one of them. NX is one if you're in like a JavaScript, or NX and Turbo Repo are both pretty good if you're in like if you're in a JavaScript based mono repository. There's another one for one that's mostly Python based. I'm blanking on the name of it right now, but it's pretty popular out there as well. So maybe look at some of the tooling to help you with that.
I looked at NX and I kind of stayed away from it because I thought it was too Java oriented and I didn't know how it would work together with the Terraform and the Python code.
Yeah, so NX definitely grew up in the JavaScript world, no doubt, and it's most effective in that if you have multiple JavaScript projects and all those kind of things. But more recently, they've supported generic commands to be able to be run on all of their tooling. So the tooling still uses Yarn or PNPM or whatever to actually run, but then you can run whatever custom commands you want under the hood to do all the various things. And it does a really good job of orchestrating those things and making sure that your steps pass before they move to the next level. Like you can define it pretty well in their language or in their configuration to make sure that happens.
Yeah, some other tools that I recall from back in the day, OpenStack uses a tool that they created called Zool. Just Google OpenStack Zool. And that also they actually use that as a gateway to make sure that different parts of different projects all pass their tests before functional tests before merging. And then in the Python world, I can also recall some bot language, some Python bots, the bot language that would have assisted you with something similar. I'll see if I can find the link here. BuilderBot or something.
That sounds interesting.
If you have dev cycles and everything else, Bazel definitely will do it for you, but it's the learning curve and the work to get there is steep. I'll just warn you on that one, but it's extremely powerful if you take them. I mean, that's what Google, it was invented by Google, if you're not familiar with it, specifically for Google. Like Google famously has pretty much their entire code base in a single monorepo, and they use Bazel tooling to be able to do all their deploys and everything.
The play on words called Bazel. I thought yeah. This was created by ex-Googlers, but
what was the one? Blaze.
I thought Bazel. I thought was created by ex-Googlers who loved Blaze, which was
maybe that's right.
I think that's right. Kind of
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Mark Timothy, who was a former Googler, confirmed.
Yeah.
I'll throw my hat in. It's not exactly answering your question, but you know, we use Atmos for Terraform in monorepos, and we've built it to detect what has been affected between any two commits in a monorepo, so you can surgically apply those components or the changes to those. And we have the GitHub actions for that, assuming you're using GitHub actions, which it sounds like you are.
Yeah. But just to be clear, that's not a general purpose tool. That not is general. Specifically like what has changed in Terraform components and stack config within that the Atmos ecosystem between two commits.
Yeah, I have found that to be probably the main challenge. Like there are tools out there, but they all specifically focus on one issue, one language.
The hard problem. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'm happy to know that it's not just me having an issue, but it's a known issue and not easily solved.
The way I think about it though, like you're doing, you know, deployments, for example, you're making changes to your code. It's in Python. You're making changes to your infrastructure. Does the infrastructure go out before your application deployments? Well, sometimes that makes a lot of sense, but other times it doesn't. And there's no unified, guaranteed way, order of operations to compute what should change first when you span a particular tool chain. So I think that's why there's no universal tool to do this. And everyone comes up with something that works well for their use case.
Fair. Yeah.
And Alan shared his suggestions in the chat there. All right. Any other questions we can answer?
No one suggested Ant or Maven. I don't know.
No one told the escape jokes either.
Yeah, or make files. You can do that.
So I have a question. Any thoughts on Amazon Shield or WAF for rate limiting and DOS prevention? I've looked into it. It looks like WAF has pretty good rules for rate limiting. That looks like it's feasible. The plus, or I guess advanced version of Shield, looks like it could be quite pricey if you weren't careful.
Shield is by default enabled for every single AWS resource. Like you get base DDoS protection. Shield Advanced, or whatever it's called, is the fancy version of it that comes with extra rules, that comes with dedicated AWS team.